Hi everyone, welcome to Aha with Alistair. I'm Alistair Willis, Music Director of the South Bend Symphony. This season's fifth and final Jack M. Champagne Masterworks is an American celebration and opens with this iconic music. Fanfare for the Common Man by Aaron Copland. This was commissioned by the English conductor Eugene Goossens, the then conductor of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. During World War I, Eugene Goossens had asked British composers for a fanfare to begin each orchestral concert, and it had been so successful that he did the same during World War II with American composers. He commissioned 18 fanfares during World War II. These were artistically important, stirring, and significant contributions to the war effort. He even suggested titles such as Fanfare for Soldiers, or for Sailors, or Airmen. Copland considered several titles for his fanfare, and ultimately was inspired by a speech given in May 1942 by Henry Wallace, the vice president to Roosevelt, in which Wallace said,
"Some have spoken of the American century. I say that the century on which we are entering, the century which will come out of this war, can be and must be the century of the common man."
Now, Goossens was a little surprised at the title, and upon receiving the score, wrote back to Copland saying, "Its title is as original as its music. And I think it is so telling that it deserves a special occasion for its performance. If it is agreeable to you, we will premiere it on 12th of March, 1943, at income tax time." Copland's reply was, "I am all for honoring the common man at income tax time." Copland's is the only fanfare that's remained in the standard repertoire. It's a powerful start to any concert. It's usual to follow a short opening piece with a concerto. However, for this program, we have two piano concertos for you. Our soloist will be the visionary Jeffrey Beagle. Here are some excerpts from our Zoom interview. Jeffrey, it's great to meet you at last. We are thrilled to welcome you back to South Bend. You performed with us a few years ago, is that right?
Yes, actually it was about 20 some odd years ago. I did Beethoven's First Concerto and a new concerto by Marjorie Rushi, native of South Bend. It was a new piece that she was commissioned to compose for a local who had passed, and they wanted a piano concerto based on her life. It was wonderful. And then I came back to do another performance with the orchestra. It may have been Lowell Lieberman's third piano concerto, I'm pretty sure. And then they also did some of my holiday music with the local chorus in the orchestra, the Hanukkah Fantasy, or the Christmas in a Minute. I don't remember which one they did. May have been the Christmas one. So it'll be fun to come back. It's been a long time.
It's time. And this time you're bringing two, it sounds like you do two concertos whenever you come with to us, and you're bringing two again, one by Adolphus Hailstalk and the other by Peter Boyer. Now, you not only gave the world premieres of them, you've got extraordinary connections with both. Which should we start with?
Well, either or. I mean, they're both very different pieces that cover this landscape of America today and just the way music has evolved in America. And they're very interesting pieces. One is by a much younger composer and one is by an elder statesman.
Uh-huh. In concert, we're going to be starting with Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, as we just spoke about. But we're going to go into the Adolphus Hailstalk Piano Concerto Number 3. You commissioned this, is that right?
Yes. And he had composed 2 and 3 juxtaposing each other. And the second concerto is more peaceful, based on the Peaceable Kingdom painting. And the only other Peaceable Kingdom I know is Randall Thompson's choral setting, but he wrote it for Lara Downs, and it's a much more peaceful landscape. Whereas the polar opposite is this third concerto, which he subtitles The Way Things Really Are. And it's a very interesting vision from a man in his 80s looking back and seeing where things have evolved to and hope for the future. And it's a very thorny work. It's a very aggressive piece, but it also brings out this kind of reflection of jazz in it as well. It's a very interesting language that Adolphus has in this piece, and a central section, which is very plaintive, very haunting, very beautiful, kind of takes you somewhere else. Then he comes back to the way things really are. And it's an interesting piece. I wasn't quite sure the way audiences would respond to it, but the Pacific Symphony audience loved it. And they got the message, and it really hit home for many people.
Well, that's great. So you did the world premiere with the Pacific Symphony. Well, this will be the second performance of it.
That's right.
Oh, well, we are honored to have you for the second performance. I've been studying the score. It's very original. I can't find anyone who, or any piece that I would really compare it to. It's his own language. It's completely unique, and for that alone, I'm fascinated by it.
It's interesting because I found when I was learning it, certain things would repeat themselves. You know, it reminds me in some ways of Hebraic writing and cantorial music, where they have tropes. And tropes would be certain inflections of the voice, little melodies that they would plug in and put into different parts of the in singing Hebraic music. And things would go up, things would go down, or they repeat, or it would come in from somewhere. You'd hear these same little musical clips in different places. So tropes would be little melodies. And he has that in here, where he repeats certain material, but in different order, almost as though things are not in order, but they are what they are. But you hear them coming at you like, oh, I heard that, but it sounds different there, which is very interesting. That's the experience I had performing it. The first learning it, I thought, oh, well, I just played that. Oh, I'm playing that again. I said, oh, but it's different here. And he's doing it next to that. And he's kind of putting things in different order to kind of create a sense of structure, which is kind of the way the world is. I really think that's what he's doing here. And it's hard to ask a composer things like that, because sometimes composers, what I've learned with all the living composers, is they'll say, whatever you think it is, it's yours now. And it's, you know, I like that in a way, because sometimes they don't totally reveal what they felt when they wrote a piece. I noticed that quite a bit in certain pieces. But it depends on the piece. And I love the feedback from living composers. There's so many that have been blessed to work with. And it helps me personally as a musician to be able to interpret music that way. It's actually helped all the traditional repertoire. When I go to play Bach and Mozart, Brahms, Beethoven, Chopin, all of that, it's a facelift on everything I've done, where I really see the music. And I remember my teacher used to say, in order to understand the invisible, one must very carefully study the visible. And it makes more sense to me now. It really is very interesting. So when I play Beethoven Emperor Concerto, it's very, very different. It's very much putting a Beethoven hat on and not a Beagle hat. And I find that with everything. So that's the Hail Stork. It's a very powerful piece. It will certainly keep everyone on the edge of their seat.
You're going to follow the Hail Stork Piano Concerto number 3 with another piano concerto. So two piano concertos on the same half. I hope you will have eaten your Wheaties and be absolutely strong to do that. This is going to take a tremendous amount of stamina. But tell us about your connection with the composer Peter Boyer and how Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue came about.
Oh, let's make it brief. Oh, gosh. Well, I've known Peter way before we embarked on this mission together. And I had actually approached a few composers, actually before Peter, because I wasn't sure if he was too busy. And the composers I approached about this, it was like in 2019, late 2019, I decided it's maybe something special to celebrate the centennial of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue in 2024. I've got 5 years, plenty of time. Well, it goes fast. And then COVID hit, and I had spoken with Peter about it. And at first he said, I don't know, I'm going to be compared to George Gershwin. It's going to be a, so I've got to think about this one. So I said, well, you know, when George Gershwin went to Paris to study orchestration with Ravel, Maurice Ravel, and Maurice Ravel asked him how much money he made. He knew he was really successful. But Gershwin told him, Ravel says to him, my gosh, I should be studying with you. But he says, yeah, I'll give you some advice, Mr. Gershwin. Better you should be a first-rate Gershwin than a second-rate Ravel. So I said to Peter, you know, maybe you should be a first-rate Boyer instead of thinking of yourself as a second-rate Gershwin.
Huh? I love it.
I got him. But he did it. He said, let me think about it. And I knew he'd come up with something, a tip the hat. It's interesting because it takes music from where Gershwin left off to the present. And of course you hear the fireworks, but you also hear that Charleston dance rhythm, bum, bum, dum, 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 throughout the whole piece. And then he has a little jazz combo section that's jazzy. And that's kind of like Claude Bowling, who wrote suites for flute and jazz piano and cello and trumpet. And Vince Guaraldi, who wrote all that famous music that are in the Peanuts specials that Lee Mendelssohn produced. So he takes that, and then he has this beautiful lyrical theme into the piece, which is very cinematic, very spatial, and reminds you of what how beautiful America is. I mean, of course, Gershwin didn't have the musicals and movies that we've had. So you know, Gershwin's famous E major theme is more like a song, where Peter's is more like a movie scene. And then, of course, he wraps it up in a big triumphant way. And it's a wonderful piece. Everybody's been loving it. The orchestra's, I'm not bored of playing it at all. I mean, this is like into the performance number 40-something in the 30-some-odd states. And we have another couple of years to go. I'm trying to see at this point about we're so close to it being the largest consortium of orchestras in the history of music for a new piece. So that was my goal 25 years ago, and 9/11 stopped that. But I think I'm going to put this Rhapsody National Initiative into that phase toward the end of its exclusivity period and see if we can manage it.
You have done extraordinary things. You have given us so much music, all these collaborations, all these this focus on living composers. I mean, you are a living example that music is a living art. You know, sure, we'll always play the Beethovens and the Mozarts and the Tchaikovskys, but it's essential to have music that's written and performed by living composers. And your initiative with this, I hadn't heard a note of the concerto, as had many orchestras, before we all decided to buy in on this. I really wanted us to have the Indiana premiere, which we've got, and I'm sure many other states were the same way. It all just seemed like a collective rush to get you and Peter Boyer's piece to perform in our state, and we're thrilled that we were able to do that. We're thrilled it's been a huge success. What a legacy.
Well, thanks to people like you that kind of joined this train with me. It's a big ride, but all these commissioning projects have been signed on by orchestras without hearing the first note. It's kind of like buying a house on land before they build it. You have no idea what the house is going to look like.
Well, we are sure that you are going to knock our socks off when you perform with us on the 24th of May at the Morris Center here in South Bend. And we trust that you have a safe trip to us again. We can't wait to welcome you back and hear these extraordinary concertos, which both really are kind of describing the way things really are.
Absolutely. And you know, I can't wait to go back and see South Bend after at least 18 years. But I get to work with you for the first time, and you've been such a great friend and responsive to my projects. You know, that's not always the case, because some people have different agendas and different visions for their orchestras, which I respect. And I'm just glad when people like you come along and want to do things that relate to and resonate with what you're doing. And that makes it just teamwork, really. Like they say, it takes a village. It takes a city.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. I've been speaking with the visionary pianist Jeffrey Beagle, who will be here to perform Adolphus Hellstorck's Piano Concerto No. 3 and Peter Boyer's Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue.
Our second half belongs to an audience favorite, Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances. It's a fascinating piece with a fascinating history. Rachmaninoff fled Russia during the 1917 revolution and spent most of his time between New York, France, and Switzerland. By 1940, he'd relocated permanently to America, this time to escape World War II. That same year, he composed Symphonic Dances on Long Island, knowing it would be his last piece. Like Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, which we explored in our last podcast, Symphonic Dances can be regarded as a summing up of Rachmaninoff's life as a composer. The piece is full of Rachmaninoff's signature romantic melodies, lush harmonies, rich orchestral colors, orthodox chants, and even direct quotations from earlier works of his. Alongside lots of nostalgia for his beloved mother Russia, there are many American influences, like jazz, syncopation, and even the inclusion of a saxophone, the only time he ever composed for one. The result is a highly virtuosic piece for orchestra, and I've always wondered why he called it Symphonic Dances, and not simply Symphony No. 4, or even Concerto for Orchestra. Well, unlike Tchaikovsky, Glazunov, Prokofiev, Stravinsky, Rachmaninoff had never composed a ballet. Perhaps this was to be his chance. Mikhail Fokine, the Russian choreographer who created the Firebird and Petrushka with Stravinsky, had choreographed Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini in 1937. Rachmaninoff was eager to work directly with Fokine on something new and came up with a piece called Fantastic Dances, with three movements called Midday, Twilight, and Midnight. Alas, the project fell through, so Rachmaninoff turned it into a concert work for the Philadelphia Orchestra and Eugene Ormandy, who premiered it in 1941. As for the title, Rachmaninoff said, "It should have just been called Dances, but I was afraid people would think I had written dance music for jazz orchestra." When I opened the score to the first movement, there's an unusual indication above the first measure, which reads, "Non allegro." Now, I don't recall seeing that in any other score. I've seen allegro many times. Allegro simply means fast and can imply a cheerful or happy mood. If he'd wanted it slower, there are other standard musical indications like andante or moderato that he could have used. Non allegro gives the instruction a somewhat negative spin, and yet the piece opens with a positive rhythmic drive. This march-like thematic figure is heard throughout the first movement. The clearest non-allegro moment is the middle section, which is slower, more nostalgic, and contains a gorgeously mournful solo for alto saxophone. the end of the movement, Rachmaninoff quotes music from his first symphony. The second movement opens with menacing chords played by the trumpets, who use mutes, and the horns, who block their bells with their right hands, creating a forced sound. Follows is a gloomy, hesitant, eerie waltz that never seems to get off the ground, containing everything from lethargy to extreme agitation. How I would love to see this choreographed. In my mind's choreography, at the end of the movement, which closes with soft, scampering woodwind and string figures, I see dancers not so much stopping, but rather being blown away, still whirling, from their somber, ghostly ballroom into an even darker night. Let's hear that music. In the third and final movement, Rachmaninoff mixes rhythmic drive, syncopation, and his lifelong fascination with chants. We hear the Dies Irae, the Day of Wrath, the chant from the Requiem Mass. Here's a brief clip. It's like Rachmaninoff deals with the Dies Irae not with dread, but with awe and playfulness. The other chant is the Russian Orthodox Blessed Art Thou, O Lord, which he steals from his own 1915 choral work, The All-Night Vigil, and remakes it here with quite the groove. This chant ultimately muscles out the Dies Irae in a symbolic triumph of life over death, which led one critic to say, "Never has death's dance been met with such joy and swagger." What an ending. I just love that. As I mentioned, symphonic dances makes extraordinary technical demands on the musicians. Rachmaninoff, as we know, was a pianist, one of the greatest pianists of all time, and he always carefully considered his performers' capabilities in his compositions. For example, he would have an accomplished violinist check the technical aspects and bowings of his string parts. For the symphonic dances, he asked his frequent recital partner, Fritz Kreisler. Of course, no violin part was too difficult for Kreisler, which is one of the reasons why the piece is so virtuosic. Symphonic dances were written at a hard time for Rachmaninoff. He suffered intense homesickness, worry over his daughter Tatiana, who was trapped in France by the German invasion, and he'd just undergone an operation. In 3 years, he would die of cancer at the age of 70. Yet the vitality and high spirits of the music in no way reflected his sad personal circumstances. Shortly before his death, Rachmaninoff moved to Beverly Hills, California, where he eloquently summed up his life as a composer. He wrote, "In my own compositions, no conscious effort has been made to be original, or romantic, or nationalistic, or anything else. I write down on paper the music I hear within me as naturally as possible. I am a Russian composer, and the land of my birth has influenced my temperament and outlook. My music is the product of my temperament, and so it is Russian music. I have been strongly influenced by Tchaikovsky and Rimsky-Korsakov, but I have never, to the best of my knowledge, imitated anyone. What I try to do when writing down my music is to make it say simply and directly that which is in my heart when I am composing. If there is love there, or bitterness, or sadness, or religion, these moods become part of my music, and it becomes either beautiful, or bitter, or sad, or religious." What an insight into his genius musical mind. Many people consider symphonic dances as his musical farewell to us. But was it? He left us this message, and I quote, "A composer always has his own idea of his works, but I do not believe he ever should reveal them. Each listener should find his own meaning in the music." And with that, we look forward to seeing you on May the 24th at our performance. Thanks for listening to Aha with Alistair on WVPE.org.